Nemoto presents American presidents. Richard Henry Lee, President of Congress, 1784-1785. Narrated with Microsoft Azure using the Christopher voice. Running time, approximately 23 minutes. Richard Henry Lee's tenure in the chair arrives in the afterglow of a miracle and the onset of a long migraine. The miracle was the war's end, Washington's graceful bow at Annapolis, the definitive treaty now in hand, the last redcoats filing onto ships. The migraine was everything that followed. Soldiers' certificates turning to dust in taverns, creditors knocking at doors, frontier fires flaring where maps pretended to make peace, states bargaining with themselves about whether promises made as a union might be honored as a state. Into that atmosphere, in late 1784, came a tall Virginian whose fame had been forged 8 years earlier in a single flint-striking sentence. His resolution that these United Colonies are, and of right ought to be, free and independent states. The drama of that day in June 1776 had branded him into the memory of every man who had been in the room. What the public did not see as clearly was the other part of Richard Henry Lee. The committee worker, the drafter, the country gentleman of Westmoreland who understood that independence, if it were to be more than a mood, had to be measured into laws, land lines, and ledgers. As President of the United States and Congress assembled from late 1784 to late 1785, he presided over the first serious attempt to convert the boundless West into a republic's geometry and to make the Confederation look, to the outside world, like something steadier than a brave memory. He did not arrive as a stranger to that work. Born in 1732 into the sprawling Lee clan of Virginia, planters whose names were stitched through the colony's politics like tough thread, Richard Henry grew up between the river's glitter and the sheriff's ledger, raised to believe that public life was the natural sequel to private prosperity. He had been sent to be polished in English schools as a boy, picking up a fluent ease with parliamentary language and an ear for the cadence of an argument. Back in Virginia, he took his seat in the House of Burgesses and learned the slow art by which a rural gentry trained itself to govern others. Petitions, memorials, little theaters of resistance that could be walked back if London softened and pressed if it did not. When the Stamp Act came, he helped write Virginia's protests, and when the quarrel deepened, his name kept appearing in the circles where practical defiance was choreographed. In 1765, the Westmoreland Resolves, local words with national echoes, carried his signature. Years later, a powder accident mangled several fingers of his left hand. The injury became part of his silhouette, the orator with the damaged hand, the gentleman who had lost flesh to an explosion and seemed thereafter to speak with a clenched precision. In Congress, he had been the man to say aloud the thing the room had been turning toward, that the tie to Britain must be cut. The resolution he offered in June 1776 moved the body from hope to fact. Jefferson's declaration poured philosophy into the shape that resolution provided. Lee's gift, then and later, was not the solitary treatise but the catalytic sentence that forces a vote. And after the vote, the dogged care that turns grand decision into daily work. He served off and on through the war, one brother negotiating in Europe, another riding the perimeter of diplomacy, and kin dotted through the army's ledgers and the colony's committees. He watched, from the front benches and back rooms, as the Confederation took shape as the only frame that 13 jealous sovereignties could be made to accept. A single chamber, no executive to fear, requisitions that asked rather than commanded, unanimity and supermajorities that protected states from one another and equally paralyzed action. Lee did not mistake that frame for perfection. He accepted it because it was the price of a union that a Virginian could live with. By the time Congress chose him to replace Thomas Mifflin in late 1784, the government had finished the two great ceremonies that made a nation real, Washington's resignation and the treaty's ratification, and discovered that a nation is not sustained by ceremonies. The delegates gathered first in Trenton and soon shifted to New York, as if the building itself might be the problem. Outside, British troops still sat in forts along the Old Northwest, citing unpaid debts to British creditors and the state's refusal to honor loyalists as excuses to hold posts that the treaty said they should abandon. Spanish officials in New Orleans closed or threatened to close the Mississippi and eyed the American West with a polite suspicion edged with calculation. Traders in London wrote letters that said, in effect, your paper is a rumor and your credit a mood. In the backcountry, men with land warrants and men with rifles looked at the same river valley and came to different conclusions about whether the future would be measured or seized. Inside, Congress counted noses, counted coins, and counted on the states to love the union enough to fund it. Lee took the chair with two linked instincts that would mark his year. First, that form matters. He believed that a republic advertises its seriousness through exact procedures. Letters that go out on time and with seals that mean something, statutes that converge on a pattern rather than spatter into improvisation, minutes that read as if the body that made them knew it would be judged by them. Second, that the West could not be left to improvise itself. He had long argued, alongside Marylanders who feared their larger neighbors, that the Transappalachian lands must become a common domain administered for the Union's benefit, not preserved as vast proprietary estates for the strongest states. Independence, for Lee, did not end at the seaboard. It had to be extended inland through rules that made settlers neighbors rather than raiders and that returned something to the treasury beyond the smoke of a cabin's chimney. The central legislative achievement of his presidency followed from those instincts. In 1784, under Mifflin, Congress had adopted Jefferson's broad scheme for dividing the Western country into embryonic states, an ordinance that gestured toward equality in the Union but left many practical questions loose and whose bold anti-slavery clause, which would have barred slavery after 1800 in the new territories, failed by a single vote. The next year, with Lee in the chair, the body returned to the problem in a sterner mood and with a surveyor's patience. What emerged as the Land Ordinance of 1785 was not rhetoric. It was a ruler. It inscribed over the forests and prairies a grid of townships 6 miles square, each township cut into 36 sections of 640 acres, each section susceptible of further division into parcels that could be sold by the acre. One section was reserved for the support of schools. A quiet, Republican assertion that learning belonged inside the very geometry of national growth. The ordinance established a method, not a dream. Lines to be run, plats to be filed, a federal survey to precede settlement so that deeds would reflect the earth rather than fights about the earth. It was, in its bureaucratic way, a poem about equality, not titles to vast manors parceled out to courtiers, but squares that could be drawn the same way from the Ohio to the Mississippi. Lee presided over the hearings, the reports, the rephrasings, the votes. He listened as men from older colonies resisted giving a distant board authority to say where their citizens might plant their stakes, as speculators lobbied for rules that would favor large purchases, as idealists argued for little farms and public schools and a future in which the frontier would not be a private fief. He kept the room to the point. He understood that the ordinance could not answer every question of justice in a landscape already inhabited by native nations who had their own geographies and laws. But he believed that Republican government had to put a standard on the table. We will measure first, then sell. We will reserve space for common learning. We will treat this land as a public patrimony before we treat it as a private appetite. The ordinance's grid beauty has often been praised and its brutalities too often passed over. Lee did not preach brutality. He did permit a logic that made it inevitable that squares drawn in Philadelphia would cut through villages that the map had not admitted. In that sense, he stands with the generation's contradictions. Rights on parchment and dispossession on surveyors' chains, schools funded by a section set aside and treaties pressed upon nations that did not believe a section could own a sunrise. To say he presided over that law is to describe both less and more than it seems. Less, because presidents of Congress did not dictate policy. The statute was the work of committees and of men who had fought in the West and wanted a method to end claims that overlapped like a tangle of brambles. More, because in a chamber that moved at the speed of fatigue, tempo itself was a form of leadership. Lee pressed the matter forward, chose the hour for the vote, and made sure that when the ink dried, the ordinance did not read like a suggestion. He signed it with the authority of the chair and sent the circular letters to the states with the tone he prized. Correct, firm, without the wine that corrodes respect. The grid began to creep across the interior like a second horizon. The West did not wait on ordinances. Even as surveyors prepared their chains, Congress had to answer war with parchment along the frontier. In the autumn of 1784, commissioners met Iroquois leaders at Fort Stanwix and extracted a treaty that the United States read as a cession of claims in the Ohio country. The Iroquois read the thing differently or read it under duress. They were divided, wounded by years of civil war within their Confederacy and by the British withdrawal that had left their villages exposed. In early 1785 at Fort McIntosh, the United States took similar signatures from representatives of the Wyandot, Delaware, Chippewa, and Ottawa, drawing lines on maps and imagining that a line could keep a settler's axe from wandering. Lee did not draw those maps. He presided over the ratifications and the instructions, receiving the commissioner's reports with their confident language and sending back the usual expressions of hope that a paper frontier could be honored by men who had never honored a paper when a fence looked better. He did not dream that the treaties would hold on their own. He dreamed that a government that behaved as a government, consistent, punctual, fortified by rules about land, could make negotiations more than pauses. If land policy was the first pillar of his year, finance was the other. The Confederation had lived for too long on the fumes of patriotism and the occasional infusion of foreign credit. Robert Morris's efforts to restore order, double-entry books, the Bank of North America as an engine of credit, a proposed impost on imports to give the Union a revenue stream, had made Congress look, briefly, like a creature that could feed itself. The impost, proposed in 1781 and revised in 1783, still needed every state to say yes. States said maybe, said never, said we will if our neighbors do, said we would but our voters do not like it. New York in particular guarded its customs house like a dragon on a horde. Lee, who had spent the war praising state independence against distant arrogance, now found himself urging the states to surrender just enough autonomy to keep the center from starving. He was not an enthusiast for a great engine of federal power. He was a realist with a front-row seat to the way promises collapse when there is no means to sustain them. He wrote, prodded, and practiced the only leverage the Articles allowed. Argument steeped in public shame. It was not enough. The impost languished. Congress kept asking. Creditors kept tapping their watches. The paper kept thinning. To the outside world, Lee's chair had to look like a credible address. He made it one when he could. Ministers from European courts, still unsure whether this new confederacy would grow into a nation or wither into a set of quarrelsome ports, sent polite letters and waited to see whether the replies came on time and with the proper forms. Lee answered. He understood the theater of respectability, that a small government made of many parts must look unified in its manners even when it cannot be unified in its taxes. He dispatched congratulations for births and condolences for deaths from royal houses with the exactness of a man who knows that etiquette counts as power when muskets are not an option. He urged American merchants to obey treaties that required debts to be paid, unpopular advice in states where war had become an excuse to default. He reminded the British that holding the frontier forts violated the spirit and letter of the treaty, reminders that produced smiles with no promises. He sent courtesies to Spain and read between the lines of Spain's courtesies to him, seeing the Mississippi dispute forming like weather on a western horizon. There was, as always, the domestic chorus. Petitions rose from veterans who cradled their commutation certificates like an insult you had to keep in your pocket, from settlers who claimed that surveyors were slow and speculators fast, from merchants who treated the Union as a character reference on a letter of credit. Lee's presidency did not produce a miracle for any of them. It produced process, hearings, reports, small appropriations, a steady tone that said the center was trying to behave as if it had a purse and a sword. He did not pretend otherwise. One can read through his correspondence and sense a man who knew he was putting straight lines on a landscape that would insist on curves and who chose to put the lines anyway, because the alternative was to accept a politics of angles that changed with the sun. All of this would be just competent administration if it were not shaded by the peculiar fact that the man in the chair was also the man who had, in a different hour, lit the fuse of independence with emotion. In 1776, Lee had forced a decision and invited boldness. In 1784-85, he enforced procedures and invited patience. The juxtaposition is not a contradiction so much as the arc of a founding generation. They were men who could write free and independent states, without imagining that freedom and independence meant a life without forms. Lee's own temperament bent toward caution once the leap had been made. He had no taste for a standing army and no reverence for a grand executive. He worried about men who loved power for its own sake and about men who mistook democratic heat for republican light. In that sense, he was the perfect presiding officer for the Confederation's interlude between war and reconsideration, a guardian of state dignity who understood that the states, left wholly to themselves, would reduce the Union to an address that foreign creditors would forget. He also knew, few men knew it more intimately, that Congress's authority was partly an act of will. The previous summer, the body had been frightened out of Philadelphia by unpaid soldiers encircling the state house while Pennsylvania's leaders counted the political cost of defending the national government and decided the cost was high. The move to Princeton, then to Trenton, then to New York gave the Congress a new roof but not a new spine. Lee tried to supply one by consistency. He did not browbeat states. He reminded them. He did not thunder at generals. He thanked them and asked for reports. He did not lecture creditors. He soothed them with acknowledgments and passed the hat again. To call this moderation undersells the discipline it requires. Moderation in a strong government can be laziness. Moderation in a weak government is the only way to keep the pieces from flying apart. If his year is remembered beyond the ordinance, it is often because of the way it placed him in the long argument about the American frame. He had been a champion of the Articles because the Articles offended no state's jealousies. He became, by experience and by a kind of injured pride in the Union's reputation, a critic of their impotence. That shift did not turn him into a centralizer. When the Philadelphia Convention met in 1787 to propose a new constitution, Lee doubted the reach of its executive and the thickness of its tax-collecting fingers. He became one of the leading voices urging amendments, especially those that would draw a bright circle around individual rights and state prerogatives. The essays that signed themselves a federal farmer, warning that a consolidated government might swallow liberty in the name of efficiency, were widely ascribed to him by friends and enemies alike. Whether every line was his and whether some were the work of another pen in his circle is, for the purposes of his presidency, less important than the fact that the man who kept the docket in 1785 was still thinking in 1787 about how to keep the country free of arbitrary power while freeing it from chaos. He would later serve in the first federal Senate and support the amendments that became the Bill of Rights, completing a line that can be drawn, without too much strain, from the school section reserved in the Ordinance of 1785 to the Speech and Petition Clauses of 1791, a belief that liberty resides in habits and in spaces that the law protects. But to stay within his year is to see him as he wanted to be seen. A careful man at a careful desk, making the United States look like a keeper of promises even when the promises must be kept in installments. He walked the narrow ridge between two ridicules. On one side, the charge that the Confederation was a debating club for men who liked to sign their names to letters no one would obey. On the other, the fear that any national vigor would become a new crown with a different crest. Lee answered the first ridicule with punctuality and the second with restraint. He let the land ordinance do the talking. He let the measured replies to foreign courts do the talking. He let the minutes, written cleanly, do the talking. He believed that the Republic could be taught to behave itself by behaving itself. His private life during that winter and summer was the life of a gentry patriarch who had given too much of his time to the public and not enough to the tobacco that paid for his paper and ink. He had a wife, children, kin in every district of Virginia, debts and credits woven together like vines in a trellis, and a river's curve that reminded him every time he rode home that laws written in rooms far away must eventually ride through rain and show themselves at someone's gate. He wrote from New York to friends in the Tidewater about illness and drought and the price of wheat. He wrote from his plantations to friends in New York about the price of credit and the drought in Congress's authority. If he ever wished that he had stopped with the motion of June 7, 1776 and let the rest of the story belong to other men, he did not say so. He had too much sense of duty and too much pride in his own capacity to run a meeting to leave the field when the field was a table. What did he fail to do? He did not conjure revenue. He could not. He did not persuade New York to surrender its custom house take for the sake of the Union. He did not convince every state that public credit is not a theory but a habit. He did not keep the British from occupying the forts in the Northwest or the Spanish from eyeing the Mississippi, because letters without soldiers do not compel. He did not solve the violence at the edge of settlement, because lines on a plat do not still the fear in a village that hears axes across the river. He did not reconcile the idea of equal rights with the reality of enslaved labor from which plantations like his own had profited. He did not pretend to. He stood, like so many of his generation, in the space between words that had outstripped their world and a world that resisted being remade by words. What then did he do? He turned a nation's vast and vague westward wish into a measured method and set aside a square in every township for a school where the Republic could teach its heirs. He kept Congress to its work when fatigue tempted it to adjourn in spirit if not in fact. He made the national correspondence read as if there were a nation writing it. He kept the faith of the articles even as he quietly curated evidence that would one day force a change. He put his signature to a way of carving order out of distance that has outlasted the paper on which it was written. Drive across the heartland and watch the roads run straight until a river or a hill insists, and you are reading the lines that passed under his gavel. He did these things without melodrama and without pretending that they were sufficient. He was a worker in the middle distance, neither the general on the hill nor the pamphleteer at the printing press, but the man at the table reminding the room that the next item must be reached and the next paper signed. There are moments in the minutes of his presidency when the tone of the body shifts from complaint to resolve, and one can almost hear the chair's voice smoothing the transition. A report received, a motion adopted, an ordinance engrossed. He believed in that sequence the way a devout man believes in liturgy. Forms do not save, but they tell you where you are in the story and keep you from mistaking a pause for an ending. When his year drew to its close in November 1785 and another presiding officer took the chair, Lee stepped away to the rhythm that had governed the office since the articles formalized it. A year and then a bow. He would be back in other roles, sometimes as champion and sometimes as critic, always as a man who loved liberty and feared power and tried to reconcile the two in a republic that needed both. It is fashionable to seek in founders a purity or a villainy that relieves us of the burden of their complexity. Lee resists both. He was brave in speech and careful in practice. He was a planter who drew the square for a public school. He was a champion of state dignity who used the national chair to impose a national measure. He could warm a room with a resolution and cool it with a docket. He believed that a free people could govern a continent if they first learned to govern a page. If that scans a small work, look again at the map and consider how many of the lines you have traveled in your life are the descendant of the lines he made his colleagues draw. Picture him in the New York chamber as spring tilts toward summer in 1785, the harbor's masts pricking the sky beyond the windows, petitions stacked, quills trimmed. A clerk reads the latest from the surveying commissioners, a delegate from a small state frets about large neighbors. A veteran's letter about a certificate sold at half its face value is referred to a committee that will produce a paragraph and no money. Lee calls the vote on the ordinance's final language. I, until the sound is a kind of music. He signs, and the Republic's most enduring measure of itself begins. It is not the sentence that made independence. It is the one that made independence livable. He understood the difference. He had, after all, written the first and presided over the second.